This is the July 25th, 2014 edition of WFAE Talks. This week, we discuss bad news that may be looming for North Carolina's solar industry. At the State House, lawmakers continue to fight over proposed cap on county sales taxes.
This bill is like a big, delicious hamburger that somebody ruins by squirting mayonnaise all over it. I can't eat this thing. This is gross.
And Houston comes calling for North Carolina teachers. And joining me in Studio D at WFAE is education reporter Lisa Miller.
Yes, indeed.
This morning you were hanging out with the Houston public school system that's recruiting Charlotte area teachers?
I did. It was a very short few minutes. So I talked to the folks there recruiting tried to just get a sense of what they were seeing as far as numbers and things like that. And then
trying to poach our teachers?
They are trying to poach our teachers. But, you know, CMS tries to poach other districts, too. You know, it's maybe not as overt as holding a singular job fair like this, but it happens all the time. And one of the things you look for is, you know, states that might have a trend that would be helpful for you. And here the trend is low teacher pay. And they say, hey, you guys have good teachers. So, yeah, so I tried to talk to a couple of teachers afterwards, but I was asked to leave the hotel since I didn't have a legitimate reason to be there. So,
okay. The other voice you heard is Ben Bradford, who's had an interesting story on solar energy this week.
Thank you.
We'll talk to a little bit more about that in a few minutes, but just to continue with this education theme, this Houston school system, they stopped in different parts of the state this week.
They did. In Raleigh and Greensboro, and they were in Raleigh back in May, actually, too.
So is this a big deal? Is this not a big deal? It got a lot of play statewide, but is this?
It got a lot of play. You know, it is, as I was saying before, it's a pretty overt effort to try to get North Carolina teachers. I mean, but CMS recruits all the time out of state. And usually how that works is you have a job fair where there's a lot of different school districts. I was talking with one of their CMS's recruiters yesterday about this. And so you're part of this big job fair. But, you know, the reasons you might go to a state, you see where your teachers have been coming from before, and you might see trends in that state, in that district that could be beneficial. And as I said before, in Houston's case, it's that they pay $49,000 for a starting teacher. And in CMS, I think it's about $35,000. State, you know, the base pay without the local supplements that many districts add, it's about $31,000. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference. So
that's sort of interesting. You know, I think and I'm not sure if this is most people, but certainly I've always kind of thought that, yeah, teachers are going to, you know, work, you know, kind of locally, I guess, right? You know, you get trained in North Carolina. I'd kind of assume you go and work in North Carolina where, you know, you've been learning North Carolina standards. Now, maybe that doesn't make any sense because, you know, in the same way that, you know, someone's going to go to college somewhere and then, you know, and then go work, you know, anywhere else. Do we have any sense of how that kind of sorts out? Do just sort of the top teachers gravitate to the top markets in the same way you might have, like, in law, for instance?
I don't think it's probably to that extent, but, you know, one of the reasons Houston came here is because there are a lot of teacher colleges around here. So they thought, okay, you know, maybe we can get some folks. But, you know, I don't know the dynamics exactly where all the teachers go to after they graduate, but I think a substantial number do stay in state. Now, CMS, for example, their biggest competitor is South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm sure that many teachers will go just across the borders, mm-hmm. too. But I don't, you know, it's not like necessarily passing the bar in a state where you can only sort of operate in that state.
Right.
I mean, you know, school districts are more than happy to recruit at out-of-state schools. So it's not quite as tailored like that. Mm.
I know in West Virginia for a long time, the state was losing population. They were shutting down schools and consolidating but still churning out graduates who really had no jobs. Very few were landing jobs. I know many went to North Carolina, and North Carolina would recruit a lot out of West Virginia colleges.
So. Yeah, Michigan is another mm-hmm. point.
Yeah.
Ohio.
Well, $49,000 starting salary in Houston, and there's no state income tax in Texas. But it is Houston.
and their traffic is bad.
Let's move on to the State House. Here's an interesting analogy made this week as senators debated legislation that would cap county sales taxes.
This bill is like a big, delicious hamburger that somebody ruins by squirting mayonnaise all over it. I can't eat this thing. This is gross.
I actually like hamburgers with mayonnaise.
I was about to say, mayonnaise anyway. Is like an underrated condiment.
I prefer Miracle Whip.
Do you know mayonnaise? As I understand it, mayonnaise is just a mixture of eggs, oil, and a little bit of vinegar. Is that?
Yes, you can make mayonnaise.
Yeah, I don't want to make it. I'd rather just buy it in large, you know, Costco-sized tubs. And I don't do that, by the way. That's disgusting. There's a certain point like where like, a quantity of a condiment becomes disgusting. I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but like if you've ever worked in a restaurant before and like you see like the tubs like where you like we used to refill. I used to work at this bar in East LA, and we would refill like the ketchup containers and everything like that from like the larger container, and it was like the most disgusting job. Like I'd have to get like
a gross noise too.
Yeah.
Probably,
oh yeah, it's so. the whole thing about it. Like I'd get like a funnel and then like pour the sauce down, like funnel it into the other things, and just and these like squeeze bottles, and it was disgusting. I don't know what that point is because I love condiments.
Yeah, but the point of what he was saying was right. Like it's,
right, yeah, you want to talk about the point? I'm sorry.
Is right that there were in many ways it was good for many counties because it sort of eased restrictions on you know how they can levy sales taxes. But if you're a big urban county instead of a rural county, you're kind of up at that limit anyway. So it's more of taking your authority away as far as county commissioners may see it.
This is now past the Senate. I haven't really heard where the House stands on this or their comments on this. I haven't really heard much from.
I haven't heard much either. And I think in Tom, who's been doing some of the reporting, it didn't sound like, you know, the House has been talking much about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of to some degree been standard, I feel like, for these bills. We've talked about this before, mm-hmm. where they really don't have to give an indication of what they're going to do. I mean, you know, we can see sometimes if it's going to appear on the calendar and come up for a vote. But otherwise, we don't really have an indication of what they're going to do. And they don't necessarily feel the need to talk to the public about it before they, you know, make a decision.
Or talk to each other.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's absolutely. I mean, yeah. We've seen that, I mean, very clearly this session with the budget and everything.
Okay, well, moving on to solar energy.
Man. All right.
Okay. You visited a sheep farm.
Oh,
this
please
week.
Tell me. Please tell me you got that sound ready to go.
I will bring it up.
I didn't have to do that bad sheep impersonation.
Well, you did, because otherwise I wouldn't have remembered that we could have just played the sheep noise. Yeah, this is. Yep.
That's all I grabbed. Really.
That's great. I'm glad you had it ready. I didn't know that you were going to have it ready.
Times.
Of course. Okay.
Yeah, that was surprising. So I went up to the solar farm, and all of a sudden, all of these sheep start trotting toward us. They're basically they use them on these farms. Actually, they use them on a bunch of different solar companies. This was in O2 Energies, which is based in Cornelius. But they actually there's now a group of farmers. They go by they have a title. The title is Sun Raised Farms. And basically, they grow their sheep up on these farms. The sheep graze and keep the grass from growing too high and blocking the sun from the solar panels, even a little bit.
Probably and then, to put a lawnmower between them all and everything.
Right? Yeah, that's probably true. And then they, but these aren't like these aren't sheep that you fleece. So it's sort of a sad story because then they get butchered and sent over to Whole Foods. And I checked this with Whole Foods, and they are the. Only North Carolina sheep in Whole Foods in the Southeast. They're only North Carolina sheep in Whole Foods, but you can get them throughout the Southeast. And that's what you're eating. You're eating lamb that grew up on solar farms.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's not what the story was about. In the same way that the condiment analogy was not about my love
really
of tubs of mayonnaise.
Our leads but we're podcast.
Basically, right. The solar industry is worried because, and I found this a great story because I have a clear understanding as a result of your reporting of what the industry, how it operates in the state and in all what's at stake.
Yeah, it's this really complicated. I mean, really what we're doing is trying to boil down a very, very complicated you know, regulatory structure, you know, utilities commission, fall asleep, snore. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, you look at the way that rates are set up, you know, what do you pay for when you buy electricity? You know, what does Duke have to do? But back in the late 70s, after the kind of the oil crisis in the Carter administration, Congress passed a law that requires, and the idea was to sort of break up some of the dominance from monopolies and to encourage renewable energy. And so they passed this law that basically required utilities to buy from private developers that are under a certain size.
And so in North Carolina, any solar farm that produces 5 megawatts or less, Duke Energy and Dominion are required to buy that.
Yeah, and again, power. It's more complicated than that. Essentially, if you're under 80 megawatts, okay. and by the way, and to get a sense of what, like, okay, so the one I would use is 300 megawatts is sort of your typical coal plant, is what I would say, to give you a sense, or kind of a small coal plant. Mm-hmm. Your typical nuclear plant is usually around 1,000 megawatts, or as Doc Brown would call it, 1 gigawatt. So these are very small. 80 megawatts, they have to buy it, but they can negotiate the price. Under 5 megawatts, and the price is actually set by the Utilities Commission. And what it's based off of is essentially how much would it cost, because they don't want rates to go up. The idea is to keep rates low for ratepayers, for us. The idea is, what would it cost the utility to produce this energy? And this is a very, very, you know, simple version. But that's the idea behind it, and that's what the rate is. So the rate that these guys are paying is a set rate. You get a contract for a certain number of years, and basically get confirmation. They know, they have certainty, we are going to have this rate over the next, you know, 15 years. So every 2 years, the Utilities Commission kind of looks at this stuff again. Solar has just become a viable and potentially mainstream technology, really, in just the last few years here.
And just to be clear, that's because they get this set rate from the power companies, but also
there's a few things that's
involved.
Happened. Right, exactly. Yeah.
And technology
costs
improved so much.
Have halved. Yeah. The cost of technology has halved in the last 5 years. And then in addition to that, there's a federal tax credit of 30%. So you can, 30% of the cost you can deduct from your taxes.
Wow.
And then we also have a state tax credit of 35%. So you combine those two together, you're talking about 65%. That's a lot of money. And so between that and the falling technology costs, the solar all of a sudden becomes this viable technology to create a business off of. And in North Carolina, if you're under 5 megawatts, you know that you can sell it. You know what you're going to get paid. So you can go out and you can seek investors and you can seek financing, and they know, roughly what their rate of return is going to be. So we've seen these companies crop up. What's happened is that, first of all, those rules have shaped how solar exists in North Carolina. So almost every farm, solar farm, right? So we're talking about solar panels, not the sheep, although, we know that they're there. But almost every one of them is 5 megawatts or less. The solar companies would like to go higher. They would like to be able to build larger than that and get more economies of scale. They would like to be able to have longer loans.
But this is all a kind of a pain in the ass to Duke, though.
Exactly. So you think about it, right? And every megawatt of energy that these solar farms build and put in place, Duke has to pay them for it. And Duke does not make any money off of it. They have to pass through, essentially, this cost. When Duke builds something, they get a rate of return. That's how our system is structured in this state, is that we have a private company, or a public company, that does it. It's regulated. Again, it's monopoly, because we want our – and the idea behind that is you want your energy company to be big enough and reliable enough, that you know that you're going to have reliable energy, and that you want to be able to create these economies of scale and be able to have low costs. Mm-hmm. So they have to pay these solar developers that cost, and they don't make any money off of it. And then in addition to that, every megawatt that comes from a solar farm is now that's added to our current electric capacity is a megawatt that Duke does not have to add, right? And one of the ways they make money, they not only get money off of – unlike the solar companies, they not only get money off of you paying for the energy, they also make money. They get their same rate of return off of when they're going to build a project, right? So if they're going to build a new gas plant, right, they get to charge you, they get to make 10% essentially off of the cost of building that plant. Now, one of the things that the solar companies point out is that when they build something, they do not get to charge you for the cost of building their plant. They assume the risk for it, mm-hmm. and they don't get a rate of return on that. So they're making their money.
It's not much of a risk.
Well, I mean,
if you're getting these tax credits and you get this set
right. Well, it is a risk. Yeah. I mean, it is a risk because you have to be able to make sure you know what your rate's going to be. It's a low. You think about this. You know, this is what would it cost? The rate that you're getting paid is what would it cost Duke to basically put online an extra unit of energy above mm-hmm. what we currently have? What would it cost them? So that's a relatively low rate. Okay. You know, they're a big company. They have to build gas plant and whatever. That's a lot of money. So right, the tax incentives are part of what make it viable. But you're a company and you've got to be able to get it online. You got to be able to do that. You got to be able to get the construction, make it a viable company, and you assume the risk for that.
But Duke wants to lower the threshold.
Exactly. So here's what's happening now is that the Utilities Commission is doing a review now. Solar has exploded so big. Usually they look through and they just have to approve a new cost. What is the rate that we're going to pay these guys? What's happened over the last few years, and some of these numbers didn't make it in the story, but basically from the time that this law was passed that allows this to happen back in the 1970s, 1978, from that time to I think it was 2007 or 2008, in North Carolina, there were about 200 projects applied for. There are now 4,000 projects that have been applied
for.
Oh.
Exactly. You can see, just how that has skyrocketed. And in some ways, that's what the law was intended to do.
I was really surprised when I heard your report that we're fourth in the nation for solar production.
Yeah.
I mean, that is...
Yeah. And really going from not non-existent, if you look back at sort of the trend line, I mean, you're talking about almost nothing 5 years ago. So now what's happened is because there are so many projects that are being applied for, the Utilities Commission has gone back and said, okay, we're going to look at the utilities request. They are looking at how these contracts are done, period, which means who can get the standard rate and how long can they lock into that standard rate for. And what the utilities have asked for, both Dominion Power and Duke, and both of Duke's utilities, what they've asked for is instead of this 5-megawatt number, to lower that to 100 kilowatts, which is 200 times smaller. And essentially, it kills the solar industry says it kills the economy of scale for what they can do. So basically, they would not want to build that small. It doesn't make sense to build that mm-hmm. small. So what would happen is they would have to negotiate the rate. Now, Duke says, okay, that lets us get lower prices for our customers. And they still have to buy it. But one of the stats that we've seen come out is of projects that have had to apply for negotiation, so these are above that 5-megawatt threshold, there have been 63 projects that have applied for that, and three of them have actually successfully negotiated. One of them went through arbitration, one of those three. And there's accusations, particularly from environmental advocates. Solar developers tend to be a little more, being that Duke is essentially their only customer, mm-hmm. Tend to be a little more circumspect about this. But the general sense is that these contracts are being slow walked. These utilities have no incentive for taking these things because they have a quarter. They're public companies. Mm-hmm. They've got the shareholders to report to. They have a quarterly dividend.
5-6 years ago, this wasn't a big deal because there weren't we've got to comply, but there aren't that many projects. But now, if you have 4,000 or so have come on. It's not you're not making money, but then it's taken a lot of your time now too.
Certainly, that's definitely part of it. And I think that there's frustration on all sides about sort of the way that process is. I think that some of the more established solar companies will look at they've got other people in the queue that Duke has to go through the applications, has to look at how they're going to connect these guys to the grid, what that would cost, all those kind of things, and it's just a huge amount of regulatory paperwork. Part of the reason that the Utilities Commission has put in this 5-megawatt threshold was to try to reduce sort of their administrative burden. And now they're looking at all these things coming through and saying, wow, that's a lot. And so the public staff, which is this arm, it's this other state body that has to kind of argue for ratepayers in front of the Utilities Commission. They've said, let's not change anything. Because they're arguing not to change anything because lowering the creating more projects that need to be negotiated would basically add to their administrative burden, and they don't. Yeah, part of this concern from the solar community is if you were to enact the things that Duke has asked for, there's basically they say it will kill the industry. Mm-hmm. And you know, we talked to a banker in our story who has financed some of these projects. He says if you lower the length of these loans, that you can't finance it. He said our bank would not, we've done five of them, we would not finance them anymore. I don't think any bank would.
They do not have a sunny disposition about this.
Oh man.
But I guess.
Right. But the other part about it is that, no, I forgot. I forgot.
I'm sorry. Say.
No, it's okay. Your pun was so bad. It just wiped out anything in my mind, but we've probably talked about this long enough.
But utility commission, when do they have to decide?
Thank you. That is the other part of it. So they're going to decide, you know, sometime later this year, they're going to have to make a decision. The amount that they actually pay for this standard rate is also going to come back up, I think, in the fall or late fall, early winter. So they're going to have to decide what to do about that. One of the concerns, I should just say this part about it, from the solar community is that they're actually – the only reason that they're able to be part of this process, they actually have to apply to the commission to let them in, because usually these are negotiations between Duke and between this public staff that are then kind of arbitrated, sort of judged by the Utilities Commission. So everybody else is an intervener, all these kind of solar community. And what we usually see in rate cases and in these kind of different things is that the public staff and the utilities decide on a position somewhere in between the two. And so that's somewhere in between essentially putting in really cutting these contracts and keeping the contracts as they are, rather than really cutting these contracts and really expanding these contracts.
Also, Sarah, it's a story that really brought it home to me about and made me made me better informed. I think certainly didn't make our listeners better informed too.
Thank you. Sure. I appreciate it.
Now we return to our Megameter segment. The Megameter is Megan Stubel. She's our office coordinator and loves to do research. We've been asking her to investigate claims and ridiculous political press releases we received this campaign season. This week she follows up on a North Carolina Republican Party press release that proclaims Kay Hagan joins Harry Reid to stand in the way of jobs and bipartisan legislation. Wow, that sounds awful. So here's what Megan found out.
This release follows a template we've seen frequently in the past few months of a shocking headline, a tangential connection between a candidate and an unpopular figure, whether it be President Obama, Karl Rove, or the Koch brothers, and then a bulleted list of offenses by the disliked person or group with little or often no reference at all to the actual candidate. For NCGOP, the main target of these releases has obviously been Kay Hagan, and they try to emphasize her connection to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
What's the proof that she stood in the way of jobs and bipartisan legislation?
So the release tells us Hagan has long been a proud supporter of Harry Reid and unconditional backer of these failed promises and practices. They quote Hagan as saying in April, "Harry Reid is our leader, and I certainly do support Harry."
Well, does that sound like she's joined Harry Reid to stand in the way of jobs and bipartisan legislation?
Well, so this is true. Hagan did say this back in April, that she supported Harry Reid. However, this response was to the question, would you still back Harry Reid if Democrats lose the majority? The release also conveniently leaves out the rest of Hagan's response, which was, and I have a huge race going on right now, and I will be victorious, and I will be back next year, and we can talk all about that then. So, to me, it would seem Hagan wasn't exactly expressing her undying support of Reid's policies, but instead respect for him as the majority leader, and actually attempting to dodge the question as a bridge she will cross when she gets to it, ostensibly after the election.
Well, this sounds like we're misled by this press release. What's going on here?
I would absolutely agree with that. I think it's a bit dodgy to take part of that quote. And several other senators were asked the same question. And their responses varied from, you know, that they did support him like Hagan does to, you know, not so sure. But it was a simple question. And unfortunately, this little snippet of her response is now being used against her.
Well, on the Megameter, how does this rate?
I give it a 3. I think it's, again, a really sensational headline that suggests Kay Hagan is tacitly supporting everything Harry Reid has done or will do as Senate Majority Leader, without providing real evidence of that support. After the quote about her support of Reid, there's literally no mention of Hagan in the rest of the release.
So one of the things I like about that is you can basically apply anything from these segments to, one of the segments Megan has done applies to nearly every single press release that we get in terms of campaigns. Yeah. That's how they all are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that. Yes. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.